The Money Show.
Make Money Mondays.
So I played you a piece earlier of Danny Kaye, who was in studio with us a couple of weeks ago, and we then spoke about the cost of divorce and what would happen if he had to get divorced from his lovely wife, Lisa. And we then knew that his father-in-law was Billy Gundelfinger, one of the most ferocious divorce attorneys in town. And then he said, hey, Billy listens to the show. And he set up my my prenup without me even knowing about it. And I've signed this prenup, and I better not ever get divorced, because otherwise Billy will have me. I mean, I'm summarizing, Billy, but that's essentially what he said. And you would, wouldn't you? You'd have him.
No, Danny's so special. I really wouldn't.
Wouldn't you not?
No.
Careful, your daughter's listening.
I'd sit them down together and look, they've got such a great marriage, mm-hmm. and please God, it should never happen.
There we go. It was a joke in poor taste, but my goodness me, did we laugh. Now, Billy Gundelfinger, please, you've got an extraordinary life story, and I want to talk about money and how money plays a role in your life, but we can't do that unless we understand where it is that you come from. And you've sent us a lovely note in which you describe the horrors from whence you come in terms of what your parents had to go through in World War II. Tell me a bit of the backstory of your parents and Dachau and leaving Nazi Germany.
Yeah, so my parents are German Jews, as I am, and my father and my grandfather were incarcerated in Dachau concentration camp. My father is the only man ever to have escaped twice from Dachau concentration camp, and my parents actually met here in South Africa in Johannesburg. My mother was a milliner, she made hats, and my father was a country traveler, sold what they termed then schmoes.
Yeah, so he would have been a smoes, he would have gone from farm to farm selling pots and pans and salt and things like that.
He sold suit lengths and material.
Oh, suit lengths and material, okay. Yeah. How did your dad survive escaping Dachau once? I mean, assuming he escaped once, he got taken back, and then he escaped a second time. It's extraordinary.
He got out twice, and what the second time he escaped onto a boat where a German officer knew he was being pursued and dressed him in uniform and put him on parade while the Gestapo and the SS searched the boat. And after the boat left German waters, one of the crew radioed them and told them what the captain had done. And ultimately, my father was dropped off, but the captain lost his life for saving my father's.
Oh, my goodness gracious me. Did your mom and dad get out of Germany during the war then, or were they part of a refugee movement out of Germany after the war? How did that work?
No, they got out the beginning of the war.
Okay.
And, we lived in Siemet Road, my family, in Bertrams, and then subsequently in Bertrams. Initially, when we lived in Siemet Road, we were the only whites in the area. And subsequently, we lived in Bertrams, where I grew up, and ultimately left home from Yeovil, but it was actually on the border of Bertrams. They always said it was Yeovil, but I never believed anybody.
I mean, I'm looking at my Google Maps now, and it's Siemet Road is very close to Ellis Park. I mean, it's that part of Joburg where you're growing, Doornfontein sort of part of the world.
And then, I started working from when I was 12 years old, selling pottery and working in clothing shops on weekends and holidays, and ultimately, when I matriculated, I got a very good matric. I was in the newspaper, and I got a bursary from Wits, which my father wouldn't let me accept because it was charity.
Explain this to me, please. I mean, here you are. You grew up in a one-bed flat in Siemet Road in Doornfontein. Mm. There isn't much money. You're forced to go and work to go and raise a little bit of money at bottle stores and in clothing shops from the age of 12. You have this exceptional matric, and Wits University deems you worthy of a bursary, and your dad says, no, you shall not accept charity from anybody.
Correct. So I then, he said, you want to be a lawyer? What do you want to do? I said, I want to be a lawyer. He said, that was interesting. And find another way. So I used to work during the day and go to Wits at night. And because I'd been working since I'm 12 years old, at the age of 23, I'd qualified. I started my own practice on an overdraft from Nedbank. There was a new manager by the name of Mike Leeming. I hope he's listening tonight.
I remember Mike Leeming. Yeah.
And Mike actually became the CEO of the bank. But at the time, when I asked him for a 5,000 rand overdraft, he laughed at me and he said, can you get your parents to sign surety? I said, but there's only one problem. My parents have got less than me and I've got absolutely nothing. And he put himself on the line and gave me an overdraft of 3,000 rand. And I spent he gave me 5,000 and I spent 3,000 on my furniture, which my partner, Kamal Natha, still has in his office today. It was good furniture. Even then, I used to buy, you know, I think it's worthwhile to buy good stuff, beautiful oak furniture. And I used to get stuck going to work towards the end of the month because I didn't have money for petrol. But, you know, I think it builds character, and that's why I'm so passionate about UNISA and the work that I do there.
I mean, you've served as you work as a professor in the College of Law at UNISA. You're also a fellow at the International Academy of Matrimonial Lawyers. I've always found that an interesting title because you're not matrimonial lawyers, you're lawyers who end matrimony. But that's another story altogether. When you look at the lessons that your dad gave you as this young man looking to advance himself in the world, and you could have had a much easier ride of it, when you look back at that lesson, how do you feel about it now, all these years later?
You know, I often look back at it and wonder. But, you know, you're born into a situation and you've always got to make the best of that situation. I mean, if one has a choice, you'd obviously like to be born into an affluent family where you know, where you could go to the best schools. I remember when I was in primary school, I wanted to go to King David, which is a Jewish day school. And I just mentioned it to my father one day, and, you know, he got really angry with me because he couldn't afford to pay it, and he wouldn't have me going to a school where he couldn't pay the fees. So I do think that you can make your own way in life, irrespective of into which situation you are born into. When I was, I went to Athlone Boys High, and when I was the first, I think it was the first or second day of, in those days, Standard 9, I saw some teachers celebrating in one of the classrooms, and I inquired afterwards what the celebration was. And they said, well, we had 8 university passes. In those days, you had A stream and B stream. And I said, that's terrible. They said, yes, but last year we had 6. And that's when I realized that I had to get out of there. And I went to Damlin College. I couldn't get an appointment because you had to bring one of your parents with you. And I waited on a Saturday morning to see Dr. Creel. He was the head. And I didn't have an appointment, so the secretary wouldn't give me an appointment, so I followed him into the toilet. And while he was at the urinal, I said to him, listen, I need to see you. I've been waiting here for 3 hours. And he said, can't you see what I'm doing? I said, yes, I can see what you're doing, but I feel like you are not taking me seriously, and you really need me to see me, because I wouldn't have walked into the toilet to see you. I don't think this is an appropriate place to have an interview. So he said, wow. He said, you better come into my office now. And I paid my fees. I used to, obviously my parents contributed what they could, but I used to sell pottery in the afternoons. So I think you can, irrespective of your circumstances, you can decide. I mean, I knew I needed to, the way that I was going to move forward in my life was by getting an education, and that would be the platform from where I could work. I knew that any other way I would have absolutely no chance. My parents didn't know influential people, and I just knew that that was the way I had to go. I just think that, you know, however desperate your situation might look, there's always some way and something you can do to try and better your life. And what's really important, you know, I was listening, you know, when I came into the studio to Jeremy about the 20 successful people. And the first thing, the first question you asked him was, you know, what makes successful people? And I think the most important ingredient in becoming successful is learning to give back to others. And I can tell you, in those days when I started my practice and I used to get stuck going to work, I immediately became involved with ORT, the Organization for Rehabilitation and Training, which I was the chairman for many years and sat on the national executive. And in those days, I couldn't afford it. But I knew that life is a big yin and yang. And if you don't give back, you're never going to have a chance to achieve anything. So the most important thing I look at, as Jeremy articulated when he sat down and all these 20 people that he interviewed, is not what they're getting out, but what they're putting in. And I can say that from inception of my practice, I've always involved myself in giving back and trying to share what I've gained with others.
Billy Gundelfinger is our guest this evening. He's a criminal attorney. He is a specialist divorce lawyer. He's telling us an extraordinary story of not only his life, but the background of his mom and dad, who'd come from very, very, some of the most difficult circumstances human beings have ever created for each other. And that is the escape from Nazi Germany to South Africa, where Billy Gundelfinger was born and certainly not much money about. Forced to go out to work at the age of 12 in order to make ends meet and paying for his own education through Damland and then through Wits, going to night school and getting into trouble with his dad for considering accepting a bursary after having stellarmetric results. We'll talk to Billy Gundelfinger in just a moment.
The Money Show. Make Money Mondays.
Lawyer Billy Gundelfinger is tonight's Make Money Monday special edition guest. It's only a few minutes left, Billy. Oh, it's the pain. It's the pain. are you careful with money?
No, not really. No, you know, I think it's there to give you pleasure.
But you come from a place where there wasn't very much of it. What gives you the sense of confidence to treat money simply as this commodity which, you know, comes in and goes out?
Bruce, it's just a passing show. And you've just got to enjoy your life as best you're able to in terms of, you know, what you can afford. And I believe in living, you know, because...
What are your biggest extravagances?
In terms of, well, I'd say my Bentley.
My Bentley. Now, that's an extravagance. Yeah, okay, that's an extravagance, yes.
And probably my worst investment is my half share in a 1936 Bentley.
Who's got the other half?
My friend Stan Rothbard.
And what obsessed you and Stan to go out and buy a 1936 Bentley? Because I can only imagine it's a bottomless pit of heartache and despair.
It is. But like everything else, you know, there's that small bit of pleasure you get at the end. Well, Stan phoned me one day from Cape Town to say there was this hotel that had this Bentley, and he was thinking of buying it. And what do I think? Because, you know, I know quite a bit about Bentleys. I'm quite passionate about them. And we discussed it, and he wasn't sure. And I said, "Well, you know, if you're not sure, buy it, and we'll be partners in it." And that's what happened.
How long ago was that?
That was probably 10 years ago.
And how much money have you spent on it together?
Lots.
What's
can't lots? Keep, you can't keep a record of stuff like that because it drives you crazy.
Are you good with money, though? Do you invest? Do you have somebody who looks after your money? Do you have somebody who comes and sees you on an annual basis and says, Billy, everything's going to be fine?
The best, most outstanding, most brilliant investment consultant that unbelievable guy. Can I mention his name?
Is he famous?
Not really. Not really. No, it's actually me. I invest myself.
No, you don't.
I do.
Do you?
Absolutely.
How?
Really, property is my thing.
Whereabouts? What kind of property?
Residential, commercial.
Joburg focused? Globally focused?
South African focused.
South African focused property. Yeah. Well, he's hard workers, Billy Gundelfinger. Let's see if we can cross examine him a little more. 50-50 residential versus commercial? Do you have a preference? What are your requirements for making an acquisition?
No requirement. I just think property is solid, and you know where you're putting your money into, and it's always been my belief, you know, from day one. That you can see it, it's there, it normally escalates in value. And I'm just, that's just me.
But you can't move property. A lot of them, people are often concerned about putting too much money into property simply because bricks and mortar are the biggest expression of faith in any political or social or geographical environment. You clearly then have an optimistic countenance when it comes to South Africa.
I think so. I am very optimistic about South Africa, and I always have been, and been positive. And especially that Cyril is about to grab the reins. Maybe not in the not for the next few months. You know, he might not want to.
You sound like a fortune teller, Billy. You sound like a fortune teller.
No, but he might not be want to be in the position that he loses a term, because, as you know, they can only do president can only serve two terms.
I see.
He probably would want to put in somebody to serve out that term. But I have great belief and. I think Cyril will be a great president. I've known Cyril since he was chairman of the Wine Workers Association.
Okay.
And in fact, he got married in my house.
Now this whole story takes on a different complexion. You tell me that at 3 minutes date. One last question. Did you once throw a cell phone into a dam?
Absolutely. The Zoo Lake, to be specific.
Why?
I think I was one of the first people ever to have a coffin. And I had this car phone, which I didn't know about, but a client phoned me from a car phone because they needed directions. The next thing, they appeared in my office. And I was absolutely amazed. I didn't even know something like that existed. It was this big contraption in the back of his car. I said, I've got to have one of these. And then, but it was confined to an area. I used to.
Why did you throw it? I've got a minute, so I'm not less than a minute.
I'll be a quick minute. Quick. So then cell phones came out, and then I had cell phone and a car phone. I used to get into my car, and I used to be on two calls at the same time. And I had so many calls one night coming from my office, and I was at the Zoo Lake, and I thought, I'm not living like this. And I pulled into the Zoo Lake, opened my boot, threw this contraption into the Zoo Lake and the cell phone. And I felt fantastic. And for many years, I never had a cell phone. I've only had a cell phone, I think, for the last 5 years.
Billy Gundelfinger, you're a superstar. Thank you very much indeed for coming in and sharing with us some incredible stories and some incredible approaches and attitudes towards money. You've blown my mind. Specialist divorce lawyer, criminal attorney, Billy Gundelfinger on The Money Show.